Welcome to Talking History. This is Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. In the principal segment of our show, we'll be discussing Galileo, the Renaissance man of science best known today for his support of the novel theory that the Earth revolves around the Sun, and not the reverse. Less well known or often mythologized is the difficulty Galileo got into with the Church as the result of his support for what became known as the heliocentric nature of the solar system. In a moment, we'll explore the history of that confrontation with historian William Carroll. But before that, let's look back at a key event from this week in history. He was an American Revolutionary leader, but today he is best known for the designer furniture that bears his name. During this week in 1775, Ethan Allen made his mark on American history. With tensions between England and America increasing and the confrontations at Lexington and Concord having just occurred, Allen and his Green Mountain Boys launched a daring surprise attack on the British fort Ticonderoga. Much to the amazement of both the British and Americans, Allen's forces took control of the fort and the entirety of Lake Champlain in 2 days without a single casualty. Later, in an ill-fated attempt to take Montreal, however, Allen was captured and held prisoner until May 6, 1778. Allen did not return to the army after his release. Instead, he worked for Vermont statehood, carved out of the already existing states of New York and New Hampshire, at one point in frustration even negotiating the annexation of Vermont by Canada. Allen died in 1789, 2 years before Vermont became the nation's 14th state. Turning to items of interest in the news, the Supreme Court recently upheld the hunting and fishing rights of Chippewa Indians, citing an 1837 treaty that exempts them from state restrictions. Neither an 1850 presidential order revoking the treaty nor Minnesota's rise to statehood in 1858 were sufficient in the eyes of the court to overrule the promises made in the 1837 agreement. In Germany, former slave laborers under the Nazis recently protested outside an IG Farben shareholders meeting demanding compensation for the World War II-era chemical giant. Dissatisfied with the German government's plan to establish a general fund to compensate those who were persecuted by the Nazis, the protesters demanded direct compensation and apologies. IG Farben was the world's largest chemical company during the war, producing, among other things, Zyklon B, the gas used to kill concentration camp inmates. And finally, the original Yoshino cherry trees that Japan gave the United States in 1912 as a gesture of friendship are receiving new life. After spending 6 months using Yoshino DNA to distinguish the original trees from those added over the years, scientists have begun cloning them. The first 500 clones will be added to those near the Jefferson Memorial and Washington Monument. You're listening to Talking History. Galileo, Italian mathematician, astronomer, and physicist of the late 16th and early 17th centuries, is perhaps best remembered today for his support of Copernicus's theory that the Earth revolves around the Sun, and not the reverse, as had been believed for centuries, a position that caused him to be summoned before the church court known as the Inquisition, ordered to recant, and placed under house arrest. It's a compelling story with a powerful image of the humble giant of science kneeling before the cardinals of Rome, using their considerable power to silence the voice of science, reason, and progress. Maybe the story deserves a closer look, just to see if we have it right. And here to help us take that look is William Carroll, professor of history at Cornell College in Mount Vernon, Iowa. Professor Carroll is the director of Cornell's Program in Science and Religion and the author of Galileo, Science and the Bible, which appeared in 1997 in the journal Acta Philosophica. Welcome, Professor Carroll, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, if Galileo was not the first scientist to suggest that the Earth revolved around the Sun, the honor perhaps going to Copernicus, why was Galileo and not Copernicus dragged before the Inquisition?
Well, the dispute over heliocentric astronomy really takes on considerable significance only after Galileo publishes his telescopic discoveries, discoveries he made in 1609 and 1610. These discoveries provide considerable support for heliocentric astronomy, and Galileo becomes a public proponent of Copernicus's views in debates in Florence and in Rome in 1610, 1611, 1612. So the new telescopic discoveries, especially the discoveries of mountains on the moon, that Venus exhibits phases, and the like, these discoveries call into question the truth of the received astronomical system associated with the name of the Greek astronomer Ptolemy. And Galileo comes to show through his telescopic observations that Ptolemaic astronomy is not true. And that opens up the possibilities for support for Copernican astronomy. So from 1610 on, you have, as a result of advances in scientific understanding of the universe, considerable interest in Copernican astronomy, and Galileo becomes a proponent of it. And it's because the issue takes on such currency in 1610, 11, 12 that theological issues ultimately are raised.
Okay, let me pursue that, because you've talked mostly science, but you end up by referring to theology. Why would heliocentrism be of concern to a church court?
Well, the problem concerns the relationship between the Bible and what science discovers about the world. Christians then and now, but especially then, accepted as a matter of faith that the Bible is the revealed word of God, true from beginning to end. And although there were elaborate ways of properly interpreting the Bible, it seemed to many in the early 17th century and before that the Bible affirmed what was obviously true through common sense, that the earth didn't move and was at the center of the universe. Thus, any claim in the natural sciences that somehow the Earth itself moved about a stationary sun would call into question the truth of the Bible, such stories as Joshua's commanding the sun to stand still. So it seemed to many, both theologians and lay people, that to argue that Copernican astronomy is true or even could be true would be to challenge the truth of the Bible, since the Bible seemed to say just the opposite.
Okay, now Galileo is first summoned to the Inquisition in 1616, where he's questioned by the Jesuit Cardinal Roberto Bellarmino. Was this, in a sense, the cardinal's position, that Galileo was calling into question the literal, if you want, interpretation of the Bible?
Well, what happens in 1615 and 1616 is that, first of all, a Carmelite priest in Naples, Paolo Foscarini, publishes a treatise arguing that Copernican astronomy is fully consistent with the Bible, so long as the Bible is properly interpreted, that the Bible is written in a way to accommodate the human understanding, and just as we know that God doesn't have hands and feet, although the Bible talks about God's walking or God stretching out his arms, similarly we could say that passages in the Bible which refer to astronomical matters are just meant to accommodate the understanding of ordinary people, and we should not fasten upon such a strictly literalistic interpretation of the Bible. So it is the publication of this theological treatise which becomes the occasion for the Inquisition to be even more involved in the matter. And Foscarini's treatise argues, as I said, that there are no difficulties in affirming the truth of Copernicus and the truth of the Bible. Cardinal Bellarmino, the leading Jesuit theologian of the day and a member of the Inquisition, tells Galileo in 1615 that it would be imprudent to argue that Copernican astronomy is true, since it seems to contradict the truth of the Bible. However, if there were a demonstration for the truth of Copernican astronomy, that is, if you could prove beyond doubt that it were true that the Earth moved, then in fact we would have to interpret the Bible differently, Cardinal Bellarmino says in 1615. By 1616, the Inquisition acts, indeed somewhat precipitously, to conclude that no, we must affirm the traditional reading of the Bible, which says, according to the theologians of the Inquisition, which says that the earth doesn't move. And Galileo is given an order by the Inquisition not to hold or to defend or to teach Copernican astronomy. And the reason he's given this disciplinary order is because the theologians of the Inquisition are convinced that the Bible truly says that the earth doesn't move, and thus to say the opposite would be to challenge the truth of the Bible. So from the point of view of the Inquisition, What's at stake is the affirmation of the inerrancy of the Bible, and Galileo is being ordered not to hold a position which they think, which the theologians think, would challenge the inerrancy of the Bible.
Is the position of 1616, does that run contrary to Bellarmino's position? Has Bellarmino changed his position?
It's difficult to know. It seems that what Bellarmino urged as prudential advice in 1615 to Galileo, that is, only hold Copernican astronomy as a convenient model, don't hold it as true, certainly without a demonstration, changes in 1616 to the conclusion that it is heretical to hold the view that the Earth moves. I'm not so sure it's a change in Bellarmino's position so much as it is a decision that what's at stake here, the authority of the Church, especially the authority of the Inquisition, to be the ultimate determiners of the truth of the Bible. And when push comes to shove, the theological experts of the Inquisition made a decision, and they decided that it was false and absurd philosophically, that is, scientifically, to hold that the Earth moves, and it was formally heretical in that it contradicted Scripture. That was a decision of a committee of theologians. And on the basis of that decision, Galileo is given a disciplinary order. He's told not to do something. Another disciplinary decree that comes out of this decision in 1616 is the decision to suspend the publication of Copernicus's book until it is corrected, and to prohibit the publication of any book which says that Scripture and Copernican astronomy are compatible. That's a disciplinary decree of the Congregation of the Index of Forbidden Books. These disciplinary decrees serve ultimately as the basis on which Galileo was tried and convicted some 17 years later.
He's resummoned. Can we assume from that, therefore, that he disagreed with or ignored the orders that came out of the earlier meeting with the Inquisition?
Well, what happens is that in the 1620s, Galileo takes on the project, a project which he had projected earlier in his life, to write a major book ultimately called The Dialogue Concerning the Two Chief World Systems, in which he examines Copernican astronomy over against Ptolemaic astronomy and Aristotelian cosmology. And he defends, at least as hypothetically possible, hypothetically possible Copernican astronomy by ridiculing the astronomy of Aristotle and Ptolemy. So in some way, he does defend Copernican astronomy. And Pope Urban VIII, who had been a friend of his in 1615, 1616, Pope Urban VIII is quite offended by what Galileo has done, because it looks as though that Galileo has disobeyed the injunction of 1616, because he has, in a way, defended Copernican astronomy. Now, Galileo, of course, thought that to defend Copernican astronomy as hypothetically superior to Ptolemaic astronomy wasn't to defend it as true. Whereas the Pope said, well, if you defend as possible or probable a view declared contrary to the Bible, that then you're indeed calling into question the truth of the Bible. So that Galileo thought he was doing something safe, but it turns out he was not doing something safe at all. And what the Inquisition concludes in 1633 is that Galileo had violated the injunction given to him in 1616, and that he defended as probable a view which was contrary to the Bible.
And what was the fate of Galileo after that particular hearing?
Well, Galileo was required formally to recant the view that he held, that the Earth moved. And then he was, as a matter of punishment, he was placed under house arrest for the rest of his life. So Galileo was forced to say that he believed that the Earth did not move.
Let's move beyond the story here briefly and talk about meaning. This is a story that's continually recycled whenever we end up in a period where science comes into conflict with religion. Why is that? What's so compelling about this story?
Well, we all know that Galileo is right. We all know that the Earth rotates on its axis and revolves about the sun. And that, therefore, we all know that the Inquisition was wrong and Galileo was right. But the historical events are not nearly so simple as that. But it's easy to make them seem so simple as that. So Galileo very quickly, by the end of the 17th and into the 18th century, serves as a kind of hero of science, of reason, of truth, over against superstition, fanaticism, and authority. And although Galileo and the theologians of the Inquisition agreed far more than they disagreed about the relationship between science and the Bible, the fact that Galileo suffered disciplinary decrees, imprisonment, and the like at the hands of the Inquisition helps to provide a kind of image of Galileo as a martyr of science. And that even though we know better as historians of science what really happened in the Galileo affair, to look at Galileo as a symbol of truth and reason against religion and superstition serves as a convenient tool in any number of debates of modern culture, whether the debates be about evolution and the Bible, or the debates be about papal infallibility, or even such questions as Italian unification. The Galileo affair is brought out by the proponents of progress, of modernism, of liberalism, and the like, and individuals, for example, who defend evolution over against attacks on it by biblical literalists. Proponents of evolution clothe themselves in the imagery of Galileo, and they clothe their opponents in the imagery of the Inquisition. And just as we all know Galileo was right and the Inquisition wrong, so by obvious implication, we all know that evolution is right and the opponents of evolution are wrong. So the legend of Galileo persists primarily because it serves as a particularly good ideological weapon in any number of disputes which seem to deal with religion and science.
Okay, well, very briefly, because we only have a couple of minutes left, let's revisit the last scene in this, which is John Paul II referring back to the Galileo's case in 1992. What did he say, and how do you view that?
Well, the Pope recognized, and he had recognized back in 1979 when he established the various commissions to revisit the Galileo affair, that Galileo suffered unjustly at the hands of officers of the Church. That is, that what the Inquisition did when it disciplined Galileo was wrong. But the Pope also was quick to point out that the abuses were disciplinary and not doctrinal, and that when you look at Galileo himself, you see an individual who affirms in his own writings and in his own life, you see an individual who affirms the fundamental complementarity between reason and faith, between science and religion. And it's somewhat ironic, the Pope remarks, that the Galileo affair should be used as evidence for this notion that there's an incompatibility between science and religion, when Galileo himself is the great proponent of the complementarity between science and religion. So this misunderstanding of the Galileo affair is something to which the Church contributed by the unjustified actions of officers of the Inquisition. But disciplinary abuses are not doctrinal errors.
Good point. And I'm afraid the misconception is perpetuated. It continues, and we hear it all the time, even in the reports on the Pope's statements.
That's right. So, for example, the myth begins with the notion that when Galileo rose from his knees before the Cardinal's Inquisitor, he said, "Pur si muove," but still it moves. He didn't say that. What still moves, however, is the legend of Galileo, much more so than the actual story itself.
Ah, good line on which to end. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to William Carroll, professor of history at Cornell College and author of Galileo, Science, and the Bible, which appeared in the journal Acta Philosophica in 1997. The much-anticipated millennium will soon be upon us, and this the first of what will likely be several historical references to the event over the course of our remaining programs of the year. Andrew Gao, professor of history at the University of Alberta, offers us his considered opinion in our op-ed of the week on the religious side of the millennium. Gao serves as associate curator of the Center for Millennial Studies at Boston University and is the author of The Red Jews, Antisemitism in an Apocalyptic Age, 1200 to 1600, published by E.J. Brill. Professor Gao has titled his piece for us today, The Legend of the Jewish Antichrist.
The upcoming millennium is not just about computers. It's also about religion and religious extremism. If we obsess about the digit bug and allow the mainstream media to pretend that the religious aspect is confined to the fringes and the tele-evangelical circus, we will be blindsided by the dangerous beliefs and plans of religious millennialism. In January, the Reverend Jerry Falwell made a reference to the Antichrist that should strike terror into the hearts of all Americans, and Jews in particular. Falwell told an audience in Kingsport, Tennessee, that the Antichrist was probably already alive and living among us. Quote, "When he appears during the tribulation period, he will be a full-grown counterfeit of Christ. Of course he'll be Jewish. Of course he'll pretend to be Christ." The New Testament says no such thing. Early Christian and medieval theologians tossed together a large number of enigmatic references in the book of Revelation to the beast, and in other books of the New Testament to antichrists. This lengthy process produced a completely non-biblical figure, the Antichrist. He was formed out of a mixture of legend, misquotation, and a crude logic of salvation. According to this logic, if Jews are awaiting a Messiah, and Christians are awaiting a beast or an enemy of Christ, then the two must be the same guy, and he must be Jewish. For centuries, Christian authorities cited the Antichrist myth as a reason not to tolerate Jews, because Jews were believed to be an apocalyptic fifth column. Influential theologians, dozens of plays and treatises, and one of the earliest books ever printed in Europe foretold a Jewish Antichrist whose followers would be Jews. Ideas, especially religious ideas, do have consequences, as Waco finally proved to secular America. The danger in this case is that large numbers of Christians would believe this hateful myth because Falwell has repeated it. Falwell might not be entirely aware of it, but the main feature of the Jewish Antichrist myth was that he would be a sinful, lascivious, wicked Jew, conceived in sin by a wicked Jewish prostitute and the devil, some versions say by her father. All the Jews of the world would follow Antichrist to Jerusalem. There they would rebuild the Jewish temple and rule over the world. They would persecute Christians until Christ returned in glory. The Jewish Antichrist legend is a prelude to persecution of Jews. It sows the seeds of anti-Judaism and anti-Semitism and endangers religious liberty. If Christians truly believe Jews are about to welcome Antichrist, imagine the consequences for American society and civil rights. However, most respectable and moderate Christian thinkers have rejected and still reject the Antichrist legend. This path is open to all Christians concerned about the appalling history of Christian-Jewish relations and would like to put into practice the actual biblical commandment to love thy neighbor.
You've been listening to Andrew Gao, professor of history at the University of Alberta, associate curator for the Center for Millennial Studies at Boston University, and the author of The Red Jews, Antisemitism in an Apocalyptic Age, 1200 to 1600. This is Talking History. Welcome back. Just as well known among the scientists of history as Galileo is Charles Darwin, principal formulator of the theory of evolution. Today we invite you to visit his home, and here to tell you more about Darwin's home in merry old England is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
A $3.8 million renovation has been completed, and the Downhouse, home and workplace of Charles Darwin for more than 40 years, is once again open to the public. Darwin and his wife moved to the 12-room, three-story Georgian house, which is located about 16 miles south of London, in 1842. Visitors can see the study where he wrote, a specimen table and a sick bay used to cater to his persistent ill health, and also there is the game room where Darwin played billiards with his butler. The dining room and the drawing room are open as well, and family portraits hang throughout the house. The upstairs bedrooms have been converted to exhibition rooms devoted to Darwin. Among the exhibits is a model of the ship in which he made his voyage of discovery and many of the species he collected on that trip. The 18-acre estate includes Darwin's sand walk, known as the Thinking Path, and the greenhouse where he studied plants. There's also a bookstore and a tea room.
Thank you, Cindy. Turning to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions, where we make you aware of various new museum exhibits, films, television programs, and websites of interest to historians, we have selected a website on Galileo. And yet it moves, Galileo is said to have muttered in reference to the Earth's movement in space. Now three European institutes are moving Galileo into cyberspace. 300 pages of his notes on the mechanics of bodies in motion, many otherwise available only at the Florence National Library, are now on the Max Planck Institute for the History of Science website, so that you can study them from the comfort of your own home or office. Simply research on the web for the Max Planck Institute for the History of Science. And if you prefer living history, you might drop by the Bartram 300 Living History Festival to be held on May 22nd and 23rd in Philadelphia. Join 18th century craftspeople and John Bartram and Benjamin Franklin reenactors as they inhabit America's oldest botanical garden at the Bartram House Museum. For further details, contact the Bartram House in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our program and that you'll join us next week when we will discuss the history behind the recent economic crisis in Asia. In the meantime, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.